gone out yet, has it? I must have missed that.
Aguero! I see it, but I don't believe it!
That is a disgusting act by Randy Moss.
No.
Horacio Fantasia!
It's been a long time!
One last roll of the dice for Leo! Leo Barry, you star!
I mean, I know he's your captain, but you can't seriously lock him as a block.
Right in front of me! Right in front of me!
Welcome back to Right In Front Of Me, the podcast that looks at the stories behind the scoreboard. So on today's episode, I'm joined by Tom Reeve. Tom.
G'day, how's it going?
Well, I think we should just get right into this. We talked about the worst losses in history.
We did, yep.
Now we're going to, on the flip side, we're going to talk about the best wins, which are the underdog wins.
Cool.
The underdog stories, the biggest upsets, real David and Goliath type stuff.
Yeah, wicked.
Tom, is there a favourite underdog story of yours?
I think for me, it has to be Leicester City winning the Premier League just because it wasn't just a one-off game.
Well, it's the whole season. And I remember the whole discourse about that was, oh, you know, it's cute for a while, but, you know, watch them, you know, drop before Christmas.
Yeah.
They led after Christmas. And
watch
we all
them
know
drop
that,
before March.
Well, exactly. And you all know before Christmas, like, you know, Christmas is the time if you're leading the Premier League.
Sure.
Got a red-hot chance and they were leading. Then everyone's like, oh, they'll drop off. And they just never did.
Never did.
And they won. And it was... It just kind of showed me being a Newcastle fan that, you know what, one day, maybe we can pull off a miraculous season.
Nice birdie.
Our first story takes us to the world of golf.
All right.
And look, I'm not a golfer. You're not much of a golfer either,
I played golf once with my dad and it was embarrassing and I swore to never do it again.
When I say name a golfer, who is the first name that immediately comes to mind?
Obvious one, Tiger Woods.
Tiger Woods, exactly. Of course, Tiger Woods. The man has transcended past the world of golf.
He's gone Michael Jordan of golf, really.
Well, exactly. He's gone into the mainstream. I'm going to list some of his accolades. He has 109 professional wins.
Okay.
82 PGA Tour wins, which is tied for the most of all time. He's won 15 major championships, including the prestigious Masters 5 times. That's the US Masters.
Yep.
And is a recent inductee into the World Golf Hall of Fame. So this brings us to the story. It's the 2009 PGA Championship, which was held in Minnesota. The par of this course is 72. There are 156 golfers who took part in the tournament. The obvious frontrunner was Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
So Woods was looking up to notch his fifth PGA Championship at the time, having previously won a 99, 2000, 2006, 2007. So he's owned the course for the past 5 years.
Yep.
So the first round kicks off on August 13th, 2009, and quickly Tiger Woods jumps to an outright lead. In the first 18 holes, he has a score of 5 under par, which featured no bogeys. He dominates the first round. It's not until the second round where Tiger Woods breaks away from the pack and starts to exert his dominance on the course. So Woods would go 2 under par in the second round, giving him an overall margin of 7 under par. Rounding out the leaders was little-known South Korean golfer Yang Yong-un, better known as Y.E. Yang. And Tom, he is who this story is about. Okay. He is the underdog in the story.
David Faraday, 206 yards. So three utility.
He's got to get over that tree and
overhook it.
Oh, goodness.
Wow.
What a golf shot. It's Corey Pavin at Shinnecock. All over again.
So a little background about Y.E. Yang. He began playing golf when he was 19 when he was working part-time at Jeju Aura's country club. And he's completely self-taught. Do you want to know how he learned to play?
He's working at a country club. Did he maybe play in off periods or once it closed? Or
he would watch other players come into the club while he worked and would pick up pointers. And like you said, like after hours, he would put that into practice.
That's so cool. That's a very organic way of learning how to play golf, isn't it? You're sort of doing it for the right reasons and you're coming up normally.
Well, it just shows that like he really had a passion.
Yeah.
And so he completed his mandatory military service in South Korea.
Yep.
After that, he moved across the Dutch to New Zealand to pursue a career as a professional golfer.
Okay.
Slowly worked his way up the rankings. The first big win in his career was in 2006 at the Korea Open. Guess who he beat to win that tournament?
It would have been... I mean, it wasn't Tiger Woods himself, was it?
It was Tiger
Woods. It was. Wow, okay.
He beat Tiger Woods to win his first big win in his career.
Wow.
So that victory earned him a place on the European Tour, and he moved into the top 40 golfers in the world. But then he suffered a few setbacks after losing his right to play on certain tours. He had to fight hard to get his way back up the rankings.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why he's playing in the PGA Championship 2009 is because he had won the Honda Classic earlier that year, and he only became the second Korean to do that.
Yeah, right.
So he's worked hard. He's not someone that just throws in the towel when things don't go right. He really pursues.
Nice approach.
This brings us back to the 91st PGA Championship in Minnesota. We enter the third round. Woods held a 4-stroke lead over his competitors. Woods played conservatively in the third round. He went 1 under par in the third round to take his overall score to 8 under par. Pretty good.
Yeah.
And remember, the par of the course is 72. And how many shots under par do you think Yang went in the third round? Shot a course of 67. So 5 under par.
Okay.
Which was the best out of all the golfers in the third round.
Yeah, cool.
He went into second place. He shot up. He just had the course of his life. And now he's just 2 strokes behind Tiger Woods
yep.
from being 6 strokes at the start of the third round.
What do you reckon Tiger Woods is thinking at this point? Do you reckon he's sort of like, oh gosh, like I'm about to get beaten by, I mean, essentially, with all due respect, this nobody to him, you know?
You always have that in the back of your mind. I'm a very superstitious person when it comes to that. So
sure.
I would be a nervous wreck.
Yeah.
I think Tiger Woods, he has history on his side. When leading after 54 holes and into the final round, he's never lost.
Yeah, okay.
He had a record of 14-0 in major PGA championships going in. So I think in Tiger's head, he would have been, I've got this. Like, I hold 2-stroke lead. If I just play conservatively again, he hasn't gone over par yet
yeah.
at all for the course.
And the frustration continues. I can't believe that didn't move right. If we really see him react like this.
The fourth round begins, and there are only 3 guys in it. There's Woods, Yang, and Padraig Harrington. However, Harrington shot a quintuple bogey on the 8th hole to fall from tied 2nd to 10th. So from then on, it was just a 2-horse race between Y.E. and Woods.
Mm-hmm.
Y.E. Yang put the pressure on immediately by registering a birdie on hole 3 to cut the margin back to 1. And this is where Woods just imploded. Because, again, if you just put pressure on him and he just thinks, who's this nobody? Woods was struggling to putt all day. He had 3 bogeys in the first course. Remember, he didn't register a single bogey.
Yeah, sure. Clearly getting to him then.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
And Yang and Woods were neck and neck on the 14th hole at 6 under par. Woods shot a birdie on this hole. So, you know, pretty good. So firing back at
yep.
yeah, firing back at Yang. Why Yang did one better? He shot an eagle.
Wow.
To go 8 under par and take the outright lead. For the first time.
Yeah.
Cursory glance. It's a good one.
It's very good.
It's a really good one.
Oh my goodness.
It's wonderful.
Fern, it's always you. In your life, Fern, you've seen another one. How did that happen?
Talk about inexplicable. Y.E. Yang, with 1 victory on the PGA Tour to the 70 accomplished by Tiger Woods, and he has taken the lead.
And now we've got a putt that Tiger really has to make.
Yeah. You never know the minute, do you?
Yeah.
What do you think happened afterwards?
I feel like he's going to continue on and go on to win. I feel like once Tiger Woods had been overlapped initially... I mean, that's the confidence shatter for Tiger Woods. And he's already done the incredible. So it would go on to say that he's probably going to go on and win.
You're spot on, Tom. Y.E. Yang would not surrender his lead. And after Woods shot consecutive bogeys on the final 2 holes, Yang had won his first major tournament of his career and became the first Asian-born player to win a men's major championship.
Yeah.
Y.E.S.
And when I got off the plane... I looked at my phone, and sure enough, he did it.
Y.E. Yang has won the PGA Championship.
Do you want to know what happened to Y.E. Yang?
I do want to know what happened. I'm trying to guess what would have happened. I hope it's not a flash in the pan.
Do you want to take a guess as to what happened?
Yeah, I just sometimes these things happen in sport where people get really big, and well, not big, but they do an amazing achievement, and then, unfortunately, it does prove to be something not as consistent. But let me know. I could be completely wrong.
So that was the only major championship he won in his career.
Okay.
Sadly. He reached a peak of 19th in the world in 2010, but by the end of 2014, he was 638th in the world.
Right.
He currently lives in Texas with his wife and three children. And agreed, I think you're spot on. Some would call his win a fluke, and I can't really argue against that. But what I can say is that it comes those opportunities in life where you have a slim chance of winning or a slim bit of hope, and he ran with it. He seized it with both hands and he took it. So
that's why I think as well calling it a fluke is probably not the right... I don't think it's a fluke because he's done the achievement. It's not like he's happened to swing and everything happens to be landing for him. I think it's maybe just a flash in the pan of a mentality that he had that he couldn't hold on to. Do you know what I mean?
I think Wai Yang saw that, okay, well, I've got nothing to lose. I'm so far gone. Shot an amazing third round and then just had that confidence. He said in interviews, like, I just got loads of confidence. Like, I just knew I was going to win.
Yeah.
Like, he could just see it. So, yes, whilst I agree that it's not, I wouldn't call it a fluke, but yeah, it's definitely just one of those things where it's never going to happen again. Everything that went right did go right.
Yeah.
But yeah. But a pretty good story, hey, Tom. Pretty good underdog story.
Amazing story. And I think it's awesome to beat Tiger Woods as well, because it could have been anyone else that was leading that, you know, has been one of the best golfers in the world. But to beat Tiger Woods, that is the person that you never think you're going to beat. You know, that's someone beating Michael Jordan in a one-on-one who's never played NBA or something, you know.
That's massive. It's high and it's long. And the weird brother out of the hangovers hung onto it.
So story number two, and for this story, we have a very special guest. I would say the foremost expert in Japanese cricket, Dani Syed. Dani, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, Charles.
You're the expert on the Japanese cricket team. What are they about?
My background with Japan's cricket team sort of is I fell into it a little bit. I had a strange uni assignment where I had to effectively write and edit a Wikipedia article. It was online writing. And we got sort of allocated topics by letter. So I got J. We had to write a Wikipedia article that was not yet written or was a stub. And so I saw the first cricket one, which happened to be the Japanese under-19 team, and went down a massive rabbit hole. Japan actually has a little bit – it has an interesting cricket history. It's not massive – Obviously, much bigger sort of football and rugby nation, amongst other things, that sort of other colonial sports. But there's a little bit there. So there's an early British colonial history that sort of has settled there. But the crowning achievement was quite recently. It was the under-19 World Cup, men's World Cup as well. A lot of these associate nations, they have quite developed women's teams, relatively speaking. So, for example, we saw Thailand qualify for the Women's World Cup.
You have been mentioning the under-19 team.
Yes.
Now what is so interesting about the Japanese under-19 cricket team?
That was their crowning achievement. And so basically what happened is in last year's under-19 World Cup, which is their first World Cup of any form, they managed to qualify. And the under-19 World Cup is not like sort of under-19 men's cricket is relatively developed. And so as a result, you don't have those sort of upset stories of niche cricketing nations sort of getting much of a go. It tends to be fairly reflective of the senior men's World Cup. So what happened is Japan had done really, really well in the qualifiers. They didn't get through. They hosted the 2019 qualifiers. They had a couple of forfeits. And then they had the final of the tournament against Papua New Guinea. And Papua New Guinea, with its proximity to Australia, is a relatively strong associate cricketing nation. And the entire Papua New Guinea team, right before the final of the qualifier tournament, was suspended because they were all caught shoplifting in Japan. So Japan qualified on sort of by default and went through to the under-19 World Cup.
Catch!
Goes. And goes. And goes.
And you mentioned earlier that they had a couple of other forfeits as well leading up to that game.
It was a little bit all over the shops. So their first game, they beat Samoa by 174 runs. Kazumasa Takahashi scored 70-odd and took forfa. Second game, Marcus Thurgate, top scorer. So he scored 60-odd. And then they had a 14-year-old leg spinner. Masato Morita took 4-for-38. And then they had the last group game was a 4-wicket win over Fiji, and they had a 15-year-old off spinner. So this is the the reality of associate cricket is that you get quite young players and quite old players. And so a 15-year-old leg spinner, his name is Yugandhar Rathrekar, who is naturally, I would imagine, has an Indian background, took five for. Then they got the final against Papua New Guinea.
So they qualified for that the most recent Under-19 World Cup. How did they fare in that World Cup? How did they go?
They had the first group game against New Zealand. They were washed out, unfortunately. They got 30 overs in and they were 2 for 200. So New Zealand were, I would fairly safely say, on their way to a win there. Then they were comprehensively beaten by India. They were dismissed by, they were dismissed for 41.
Chip to mid on as well, and a good catch. So Japan, bowled out for 41 by India. India, no doubt, happy with their work.
Before India chased it down in less than five overs. I've got the scorecard in front of me. The main destroyer was a bloke named Ravi Bishnoi, who is on the books at the Kings 11 Punjab. Then their last group game was against Sri Lanka, so they were bowled out for 43, and Sri Lanka chased it down within nine overs. And they lost their playoff quarterfinal against England by 9 wickets. And then they went off into a 13th place playoff semi-final. So for the 13th place playoff semi-final was against Canada, and they were dismissed for 118, chasing 300, which is where Neil Date scored, which is one of the vice-captain, and scored 59. And then their last game was against Nigeria at Potchefstroom, and that was, they lost by 8 wickets, defending 115.
There's a whole other world out there in terms of cricket nations and associate cricket nations. What's your take on associate cricket nations?
Cricket is split into, it used to be split into three tiers. It's now split into two tiers. So basically there's what we call full member nations of the International Cricket Council, the ICC. There's 12 of those and they play test cricket. Below that, there's everybody else, and they're called associate nations, and they're not allowed to play test cricket. They typically, they're not what we would regard as traditional cricket playing nations, and some of those have one day international status. They're allowed to play 50 over games that are classed as one day internationals, and that requires grounds that have certain standards, typically turf wickets of a certain level, and you have to win your World Cricket League divisions, and there's certain qualifications for that, and the countries that have ODI status change sort of year on year. So I'm really passionate about all of these countries that don't typically play the game, because, you know, you and I, we both love cricket. We both love to see. I think there's nothing more special than introducing something. So whether it's cricket or not, someone to something you love, and for them to sort of pick it up and run with it. And I think that's what associate cricket is en masse.
I think with associate cricket, it's a real underdog factor as well. I think, although they're no longer an associate nation now, Afghanistan, who have recently gained test status, rose through the ranks through the associate nation brackets. And I think we've seen, you know, sides like Scotland and Papua New Guinea in the most recent T20 World Cup not win any results, but kind of generate headlines. And I mean, we saw Ireland who also have test status, bowled England out for 60-odd or 70-odd at Lords. And I think there's a lot of great stories to come from associate nation cricket.
Brathwaite, remember the name. History for the West Indies.
My final question to you, is there another associate cricket nation that we should all keep tabs on in the future?
Oh, absolutely. I wish I could tell you all about more than one. Namibia have made massive headlines in the T20 World Cup recently. They've got quite a strong rugby culture. There's a lot going on in Namibia, and there's a lot of opportunity there cricket-wise, and they've done really, really well, and they've taken a few ex-South African cricketers, and there's been quite a lot of support from the South African.
David Visser.
Exactly. David Visser used to play for South Africa in 2016. He's now playing for Namibia. He's sort of been their sort of superstar. He's their bedrock. Second one is the United States. So the United States this is really interesting, because the United States typically, obviously in pretty much every other sport you can think of, is an absolute powerhouse. And the Americans quite famously don't like not winning gold. Americans have never picked up cricket. They have a really, really fascinating history with cricket. Obviously, United States was once upon a time a British colony, and the first ever international cricket game was between Canada and the United States. A lot of people think it's between Australia and England. It's not. It's between Canada and the United States, and it was in New York. And if you visited New York and you've been on the High Line, which is a tourist attraction in New York, that is where the first ever international cricket match was once played, in Manhattan.
That's the true home of cricket. Forget Lords. New York is the true home of cricket.
And so what's happened is that cricket has sort of laid dormant for 150 years. And now when you see these sort of waves of immigration to the United States, particularly from the subcontinent, there is a real desire for Americans to be represented there. It has international quality stadiums. There's been ODIs hosted in Florida at Fort Lauderdale. The West Indies have played games. There's been American 11s that have first-class status. And basically what's happening now, I promise I'll wrap it up soon, is Major League Cricket is coming. In the same way that we have Major League Baseball and the same way we have Major League Soccer and Major League everything else, there's Major League Cricket. And this is really, really exciting.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Dodge, for this chat about, I think, the Japan cricket team and then also, I guess, the minnows in cricket and place and teams to look out for. So thank you very much for joining me.
Absolutely. You know, I love talking associate cricket.
I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win.
Our last story, and you'll like this one being the football man that you are.
Yep.
Takes us to Brazil for the 1950 FIFA World Cup.
Ooh, okay.
For a group pool game between the United States and England.
Right. Always a feisty affair as well, England and USA. Yeah,
taking it back to the 18th century.
Well, whenever England, USA or Australia play each other, there's definitely a vibe.
England go into the match as heavy favourites, despite the fact that this is the first time England has ever featured in the World Cup.
Wow.
Do you know why?
I would have guessed it would have something to do with World War II.
It was due to pay disputes with the World Cup, and they boycotted the last three tournaments because they weren't going to get paid enough.
Okay.
So England, in 1950, they'd been dubbed the Kings of Football due to their impeccable post-World War II record.
Yep.
So they'd played 30 games since World War II. How many wins do you think out of those 30 games?
Is this World Cup games or just like international
games?
I'm tempted. It might be 27, 28.
You're not too far. 23 wins. Four losses and three draws.
Yeah, cool. Very good form.
And this is just against nobody either. Mm. These are 4-0 wins against Italy and 10-0 wins against Portugal.
Wow.
Just 2 weeks before the England-USA game is meant to be played.
Yeah, okay.
So they're not beating nobodies. Yeah. They're not beating American Samoa 31-0.
Yeah. What country would do that?
Not only were England heavy favourites in this match.
Yeah.
They were 3-1 odds to win the entire World Cup.
Okay. And how are the United States at this point? I mean, they were just sort of deemed similar to they are at the moment where they're a good team, but not like a favorite or...
The US were coming off an international game losing streak of 7 matches, which spanned the 1934 World Cup and the 1948 Summer Olympics.
Yeah, okay.
So they're coming on the opposite end of form.
Yeah.
They had a combined score in those 7 matches of 45-2. With blowouts like 7-1 to Italy and 11-0 to Norway.
Oh, dear.
Not great. Like I said, this has shades of American Samoa against Australia. And it makes sense because the majority of the US players were amateurs and semi-professionals. They had other jobs outside of just playing football.
I'm just trying to think what football would have been like in the 50s in the United States as well. We wouldn't have been a major sport. That my mind goes to baseball and places like that, which it still does now, but particularly in the 50s as its pastime. And
Harry Keogh was a member of the US team.
We still were feeling pretty good about ourselves because we had really scared the hell out of Spain, you know. And then we had another 2.5 days in between to play England, so we certainly didn't entertain any ideas we were going to beat them, you know, but we figured we could give them a battle for it.
Onto the game. And Tom, do you have any predictions?
Well, I have an inkling that the United States have won this because we are in the...
we are talking about the underdog story. But if you were to just have a guess, what do you think?
Score-wise as well.
Yeah.
I am going to... Okay, I'll give you quite a specific guess. Mm. So I think England were winning at halftime. And then I think the United States come back. And I reckon the United States win 3-1.
Okay. You're wrong. But I'll tell you what happens now. So a fun fact. England are wearing all blue jerseys for this game.
That's that. Yep, they used to wear that quite a lot, and they have dipped back to that on occasion when they wear it.
I kind of like it, but like the reason they wore it was to not clash with the US because the US had that white strip.
Yep.
Within 12 minutes, England had already registered 6 shots on target. 2 of those hit the woodwork.
Oh, wow.
England counterattacked really well. And if it weren't for US keeper Frank Borgi, who drove a hearse for his uncle's funeral home in his day job.
Oh, very good. Park the bus and then park the bus, eh?
Yes. Nice. If it weren't for him, England would have been in front by loads.
Sure.
He did an unbelievable job as keeper. He made 3 consecutive saves in the 30th. 31st and 32nd minute, respectively.
Wow.
So just a constant barrage of shots firing. In the 37th minute, US player Walter Barr, whose real job was a high school teacher, had a long shot that took a deflection off a US player. English keeper Bert Williams' momentum went in the complete other direction, and he watched the ball sail into the back of the net. The US were up 1-0.
Yep.
So, who do you think the Brazilian crowd was supporting at the time? There were 10,000 there initially. Who do you think they were cheering the loudest for?
I think the United States. If we're going in Brazil, it seems that the United States would be the sort of favourite amongst the crowd.
You're spot on. That's right.
Underdog as well.
And it's, yeah, that's my point.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon for local crowds. I think Australia does it as well for anything. You support the underdog because we all love those kind of miracle stories of like a team that has no hope and Bob Hope.
Yeah.
And they somehow pull off an amazing win. I think that's universal, not just for Australia.
And there's nothing exciting about just like a run-of-the-mill normal win for England over the United States, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the crowd was initially 10,000 people, but as the match progressed and the US hit the lead, the Brazilians began to flock to the stadium and support the Americans. They cheered every save, every thwarted British attack. Walter Barr, who had the shot that took the deflection.
Yep.
He described the atmosphere as something he'd never seen before and couldn't believe the support they were getting. It turns out the reason why the Brazilians were rooting for the US was not just because the underdogs. Brazil were probably most likely going to play England in the early stages of the knockouts.
Right.
And because England were the favourites, the Brazilians didn't want England to win this
game.
They wanted an easy game, didn't want to play England in the earlier parts of the knockout stage. Something that Barr didn't realise until the end of the match. So he found out later on. Which I think is pretty funny. But
yeah.
I mean, I think you'd still get the support no matter what. You'd still be more than happy.
Yes,
to.
But it's not as noble a reason to support, is it? As we originally thought.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the goalie was on the ground and the ball was behind him in the goal and nobody knew where the hell the ball went until they saw it bouncing up and down with the net. That was at the 37th minute of the first half. So, you know, we were just going to hold on. We got to hold on till the half.
So the second half. The US were actually the team making the plays and opportunities, not England. The US mentality, and I agree with this wholeheartedly, is that we can't just sit around and protect our lead.
Yeah.
Because England have some star players, some of the best in the world during the 1950s. They're just going to run over the top of us if we just park the bus, go in our shell. So they were being really aggressive. With 8 minutes left in the match, Englishman Stanley Mortensen was brought down just short of the penalty box. The English players pleaded for a penalty because they thought it was in the box.
Yep.
But a free kick was awarded instead, inches just outside. The free kick looked destined to go in, but Borgi, again, tipped into the crossbar. It bounced inches on the goal line and was recovered by the US keeper. Again, the English player said, it's crossed the line.
Yeah.
But the referee waved his hands away.
Reminds me of a lot of other times with England as well.
But how handy would VAR be back in the day? If this is, I mean, this is 1950, so of course we're not going to get it. But
we'd get some sort of like major camera where it's got the big flash happening. Oh no, that very distinguished ball looks over the line in the black and white photo.
Exactly. And that was their last real chance. They made a couple of chances that were either saved or blown away. But the final whistle blew and the US had won. And one of the greatest upsets in sporting history.
Wow.
Now, this is where the story is really great. It's the aftermath.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, football isn't that big in the US, especially the 1950s.
Yeah.
The only journalist who was at the World Cup from the US had to cover his own expenses to go on the trip because his publisher wouldn't provide it for him.
Wow.
And it was only a small article in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Also, the loss really didn't make it in a lot of publications in England. Do you want to guess why?
Probably because it's quite embarrassing for the England national team to lose to the United States. You know, it's funny. I actually would have thought it would have got a lot of publicity, but like really scathing on the England team.
There was publicity.
Sure.
But not as much as you would think after. Because I agree. Embarrassing. And the reports that were there were very scathing to critique.
More of the sweep under the rug traditional way from the press this time.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
But on the same day that England lost to the US in the football, England suffered their first ever home defeat to the West Indies in the cricket, which is what a lot of papers made their front headline story and what they're reporting on. That's why the football game didn't get as much coverage. It still got coverage, but they were focused more on the cricket and that how could we lose to the West Indies?
Yeah.
How could we lose to all of our colonies in all these sports?
We made them and then we lose to them.
I know. And it's still that tradition still goes to this day because as we're recording this, England lost to New Zealand last night in the T20 World Cup, and I, for one, could not be happier.
Good stuff.
The blue England kits were worn once more in 1959 in a 4-1 loss to Peru.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't been worn again. There have been variations of them.
Yeah.
But the classic just blue hasn't been worn again.
I think I've seen them in the classic shops.
Yeah.
Like you can buy them, but
they haven't been worn. There were protests from England over the legitimacy of the citizenship of some of the US players. So very similar to the 31-0 American Samoa stuff that we covered earlier in this podcast where there were some issues around that. But these were shot down pretty quickly.
Okay.
There was nothing bad about it.
Yeah.
So England, they still had a chance to progress to the group because that was their second game.
Okay.
England had to play Spain in the next match and needed to win to make it to the knockout stage. But they lost 1-0. So they didn't make it to the knockout stage after being favourites to win the World Cup.
Did the United States make it out?
No. Ah. So the US and England finished on the same amount of wins and losses.
Yep.
One win and two losses.
Okay.
The match has now been come to known as the miracle match. The US, remarkably, have only ever played and one other World Cup match against England.
Yep, and that would be 2010.
Correct, that is 2010. I was going to ask you. 2010.
Great Rob Green little fumble in that one as well.
Yes.
I remember watching that live.
Yes,
not a good moment for him, but...
Yeah, he fumbled a Clint Dempsey shot and...
1-1, the score?
Correct. That's an excellent memory. I was going to quiz you on that, but you know it straight away. You know your football, Tom.
Thank you. Steven Gerrard with the other goal.
Mate, correct. You're nailing it. Oh, mate, do you want to host it? I think
we'll swap right now.
Well, they have a chance here. There are four forward, and this could be menacing with a good turn from Dempsey. Tries to get away from Gerrard, fires it in hard alone, a desperate mistake by Robert Green. Clint Dempsey brings the United States level. It's a moment of horror for the goalkeeper.
So the US have never lost to England in the World Cup.
Yeah, wow.
One win and one draw.
There you go. That's awesome. I mean, that's great for the US. I think the US have always been a solid team. I think... I view them slightly higher than Australia. I think they're...
I think so too.
Yeah, like they're sort of the next step, but similar level. But I think, with the MLS as well, which is a pretty solid foundation for their league. They pull a lot of players from that league as well.
What are you guys going to do? Are you going to continue to be a bunch of soft, underperforming, tattooed millionaires? You are a soccer generation that has been given everything. You are a soccer generation who is on the verge of squandering everything. So now it's time to pay it back. Make us believe again.
So you've heard the three stories, Tom.
Yep.
And just to recap, it's Wai Yang wins the PGA Championship from out of nowhere against Tiger Woods. The Japanese cricket team miraculously making it to the Under-19 World Cup.
Yep.
And the US beating England at the World Cup. If you were to tell someone your favorite underdog story from sport, which one are you telling first? Which one's your favorite out of these three?
I think my favorite is the Tiger Woods loss because it seems probably the most unlikely. And beating Tiger Woods. Something about one-on-one with a sport as well, when you're beating someone and it's just one other person against someone who's so highly esteemed. A lot of variables can go wrong with team sports. When it happens in a one-on-one sport, I think it's even more impressive. So I'm going to give that one my vote.
Make it unanimous. I completely agree. Taking nothing away from the US beating England, that is also a really massive achievement.
Yeah.
But I think, to beat Tiger Woods, like you said, the Michael Jordan of golf...
Roger Federer.
He's the GOAT of golf.
Yep.
So to beat him is such an amazing achievement. And it just happened out of nowhere. So I think that's why I have to make that the biggest underdog story in sport.
Yeah.
Well, Tom, that's it. That's us done for another episode. Is there anything you'd like to plug before we finish?
Just great to be back in the studios, Charles. It's been great to be doing one of the shows outside of the studios, but I certainly prefer doing it back in here. So, yeah, great to be back.
Definitely. Thank you very much for tuning in to another episode of Right In Front Of Me, where we look at the stories behind the scoreboard.
There we go. Crowd cheers. Here's Siddle. Oh, well, Miles is close. He's going to... Extraordinary finish here.
Wherever you've been watching this brilliant game of ours.